This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu rolls out his state budget proposal, and some of his non-budget priorities, like right to work and undoing same-day voter registration, seem to be losing steam in the New Hampshire House. And a report on opioids finds some good news and some bad news on the crisis in Manchester. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Kathleen Ronayne, Associated Press, Dan Barrick, New Hampshire Public Radio, and David Solomon, the New Hampshire Union Leader. Good morning, all. Let's get right to the budget. The big picture is $12.1 billion in total spending. That's $700 million above the current budget. No new taxes or fees or layoffs. It aims to top off the rainy day fund at $100 million and send overage to infrastructure projects, all without accounting ledger domain, so says the governor. Why don't we take a listen to how he pitched his budget? Let's listen to his principles. This would be clip 7.
This true balance is achieved by ensuring that spending in fiscal years 18 and 19 is based entirely on revenue for fiscal years 18 and 19 and does not anticipate nor rely on revenue carried forward as surpluses from prior fiscal years. Those are one-time revenue sources in those instances that should be strictly used for one-time expenditures and not appropriated for long-term programming. These have been and will continue to be some of the guiding principles in developing this budget. It may stand in stark contrast from actions of previous administrations, but it is responsible, it is practical, and it addresses our state's true priorities.
That was Governor Sununu yesterday. So that's his rationale for his budget. I've got to say, true balance sounds like some sort of high-fiber supplement. But why don't we get to the policy? What in this budget leapt out at you all, Kathleen?
Well, I think that everyone was kind of waiting to see if there would be any type of money in there for full-day kindergarten. That was something that Democrats in particular were pushing, but definitely had some Republican support as well. You know, the way the system works now, even if a district has full-day kindergarten, they only get half the normal amount of money per student. And so Sununu did something interesting in his budget. He put $9 million a year towards it. But instead of saying it's a uniform amount that every student gets the full adequacy amount when there's full day kindergarten, he's going to target it to districts that have a high level of need. So a district that maybe has a poor property tax base or more low income students, more English language learners. They would get a little bit more money. Now, his budget director says that every district will be poised to get some type of money based on a formula. We haven't seen that formula yet, so we don't know exactly what that looks like. But, you know, a district like Manchester would probably benefit pretty greatly from something like this.
Well, why don't we take a listen to how the governor put it yesterday?
Under the new program, the Department of Education would be directed to distribute $18 million over the biennium to communities that have approved full-day kindergarten. State aid would be allocated among communities based on a measure of relative need, with factors including a community's relative property wealth to that in relative to the rest of the state, participation rates for free and reduced lunch programs compared to statewide averages, and communities with high percentages of English language learner students.
All right, that was Governor Sununu yesterday talking about what he described as his targeted full-day kindergarten program. And Dan, obviously the factors that he cited there are ones familiar to those who follow the broader debate on school funding.
Right, and the partial, the targeted part of that is one of the handful of things that Democrats who took issue with some of his policy proposals in the budget noted. But I think it's a good example of, you know, any governor's budget is a financial document, right, a series of numbers that have to add up to zero. But it's also a political document. And I think on the politics, I think Sununu's budget actually, he did quite well by himself. I mean, there's nothing wildly objectionable in here that is going to, at least so far, cause much problems for him. It allowed him to make put forth a few proposals. The targeted kindergarten was one. This infrastructure bank was another. Increases to developmentally disabled wait list. Things that even if he gets one or two of these go through the process, he'll be able to you know, talk about them with voters and claim wins. The financial, as a financial document, I do think we're starting to see in the wake. I mean, he only released this less than 24 hours ago, so there's still a lot of unpacking. But you're starting to see critiques from, say, the Hospital Association yesterday complained that he's underfunding the uncompensated care line for which hospitals are reimbursed by the state for care they provide to people without insurance. The university system yesterday released a statement expressing great disappointment that he flat-funded the public universities from the previous budget. So some of those sort of more questions about whether financially he's making the right investments are yet to come out. But, you know, just based on the political feedback that you saw yesterday, there was very little of significance, I think, that he's sticking his neck out on in this budget.
David?
Yeah, well, in line with what Dan's saying, the governor's found and presented from a policy perspective a very middle-of-the-road, split-the-baby kind of budget, very representative of the kind of governor he's presented himself as, not a fire-breathing ideologue, but a moderate tactician, a practical Republican. And you see that in so many ways. For instance, in the kindergarten thing, instead of going, we're just going to go full student grant per kindergarten student, which would be truly fully funding a full-day kindergarten, he has created a need-based program. Instead of fully going with the taking 5% of liquor commission revenues to fund the alcohol treatment programs in the state, he's going up from the existing 1.7% to 3.4%, not the full 5% that the alcohol recovery and drug recovery community wanted, but probably not the 1.7% that some of the more conservatives would have wanted to stay at. In school building, rather than restoring the traditional program where all qualified schools get state aid for qualified school building projects, he's created a targeting program that's going to identify where there are safety and health issues that need to be addressed. Disappointed the university system with level funding, but is increasing funding to the community colleges that are more seen as connected to the workforce issues facing the state.
And also the $5 billion scholarship fund for the university system, a way to get money, as he put it, directly to the students rather than the operating budget of the universities.
But even in some of his scholarship programs, he's targeting them in many respects to nurses who intend to stay in the state, for instance, to address the health care needs. So he just seems to be taking this strategy of far from entitlement programs where you just get so much per person, period, much more structured on the basis of need and applications that will have to demonstrate need.
Well, to stick with kindergarten for a minute, one thing that struck me in the wake of the speech was comments that House Speaker Sean Jasper made suggesting that he thought at least that kindergarten might be a tough sell. Why don't we take a listen to what he said?
This is in context of job creation is what is being proposed. I think some of us think that we can probably figure out a better way to do that. But as you know, I mean, it's no surprise Republicans have not been in favor of state-supported kindergarten, that we believe that is a local option.
So that was House Speaker Sean Jasper after Governor Sununu presented his budget. And Speaker Jasper has in the past criticized full-day kindergarten, saying that he believes personally that kindergarten is a time when it's more about socialization than the delivery of education. Kathleen, do you have a sense of whether or not Jasper's kind of out there on his own on this a bit, or whether there will be real resistance in the House?
You know, it's hard to tell. I was asking Jasper, as well as Neil Kirk, Finance Committee Chairman, and Rick Ladd, who's Chairman of the Education Committee. We were talking a bit about this yesterday, and I think after the speaker made those initial comments a little bit later when I was talking to him, he sort of not walked it back, but didn't so explicitly say this is not going to happen. It was more, oh, we have to take a look at everything that's in the budget and we might want to make changes. I think any time where you have a significant amount of new spending, which the House would consider $18 million to be a significant amount of new spending, you're going to have Republicans in particular really picking it apart and trying to determine whether or not it is something that's effective. So I could see it facing – I don't think he's completely out there on his own from Republicans being skeptical about this program. And I wonder, I'm not sure if Sununu's need-based program or help or hurt, because on the one hand, you know, they might be more open to a program that is a little bit more specifically targeted toward districts that are in need.
Dan?
And just in education in general and kindergarten in particular, on the campaign trail and yesterday in his speech, Sununu talked about this issue in terms of himself as a father of three young children, somebody who's been in the schools. Yesterday he said, I hear from lots of people that access to kindergarten is a factor in how they where they choose to live and send their kids to school. So he has this anecdotal kind of approach. But he's also very much in line with some of the more policy and research based that we've been seeing the last few years about the importance of early childhood education. So,
even from an economic development standpoint, as he's going around trying to recruit businesses
exactly.
to come here, one thing that they ask is, oh, to the school system, and oh, I'm going to locate my business here and I want my employees to be focused on their job and they're hustling around trying to schlep their kids from place A to B.
You've even heard anecdotal stories from realtors around the state by looking at what communities in the state are growing. It's those, you know, if you've got two communities next to each other, one with a full-day kindergarten program, one without, buyers will sometimes express a preference for the one with the full-day program. So that's an argument he may make. It's hard to say how much political capital he's going to want to put into this fight, but it's one of the few kind of, you know, specific policy initiatives that he put in the budget yesterday.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're talking about Governor Sununu's proposed state budget. He unveiled that yesterday. It's going to be a long slog till June, but certainly a lot to chew over. And, you know, one thing I was thinking about as I listened to the budget yesterday is the flexibility that the governor has, both given the financial state of the state. You know, he talked a lot about how there weren't going to be what he would term gimmicks, there weren't going to be carry forwards, there weren't going to be one-time revenue. You know, that's some might say that's a luxury he can live by given the health of our revenue situation. I mean, another thing I was thinking about, though, is that he entered into this budget situation not really armed with a you know, handful of promises that he necessarily had to deliver. And, you know, kindergarten was something he had expressed support for on the campaign trail. He certainly wasn't going to have new or increased taxes. But, you know, as we enter into the kind of horse trading part of this debate, are there things in here that you believe he absolutely wants and will really fight for? Or is it just about getting to a number that everyone can agree on?
Well, there's certain things I think he believes he has to have, and the existence of the surplus that you described in great part makes it possible. There were certain areas where he didn't go with the half a loaf approach at all. I mean, he wants to fully fund services to the adults in the state with developmental disabilities, for which there's a long waiting list. He wants to get the number of social workers in D.C. in the Division for Children, Youth, and Families up from 86 to 120, as recommended by the outside consultants. He wants to fully fund staffing to open the women's prison. He seems to be targeting the kind of things that if we don't deal with, we're going to be sued down the road and be forced to deal with by lawsuit, the way New Hampshire has been forced to deal with other issues in the past.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he also talked quite a bit during the campaign and in his inaugural address about the importance of addressing the opioid crisis. And I'm still interested. I still need to unpack a little bit and talk to some advocates about to what extent this budget actually tackles that. You know, it does add, as Dave mentioned, it doubles the percentage of liquor sales that go into this alcohol fund that a governor's commission can use kind of innovatively. It's not tied to, you know, federal requirements and strings. So there's about $3 million extra in there. It's certainly not everything that advocates wanted. He's added 10 new state troopers to focus on drug enforcement. So there are a couple different things he's doing to touch on the opioid crisis, but I think I was a little surprised that it wasn't a bigger focus of the speech.
I agree. Why don't we hear, this is a little bit of him talking about opioids yesterday.
First, I propose that we double the alcohol fund, increasing these important resources by more than $3 million, creating incentives to ensure that those funds are truly spent. I believe that we need a renewed emphasis on recovery programs in the state. So I've established within the Office of Substance Abuse a specialist to work alongside with our drug czar, James Vara, who has done a tremendous job for us. but to help coordinate policy focused on treatment, recovery, and prevention, providing pathways for folks battling addiction back in our communities.
All right, that was the governor talking about policies germane to the opioid crisis. And, you know, during his inaugural address, he talked about working to make sure that every pathway for recovery was open. And I guess I took that to mean that there might be state funding that would go towards, you know, reimbursement for treatment modalities of various sorts. And, you know, we get it. We hear a little bit of that here, but there's a lot of things that I guess maybe they're buried in the budget or maybe they're going to be subject to debate.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell right now. And I think just for people listening, you know, we have the budget document now that shows us the numbers, but we're still waiting on the bill that goes along with it, which is known as HB2, that actually is the enabling legislation that shows us how this stuff works. So it'll show us, you know, how we're allocating full-day kindergarten money, or it'll show us if there is specific policy or legislation dealing with, you know, more access to prevention, treatment, and recovery programs like he's talking about. So, at this point, it's hard to say. I mean, I think the legislature broadly has realized that tackling the opioid crisis is a major problem. They did do quite a bit on that last session, and I think it's an area where there's bipartisan support. But, you know, I'm not suggesting there's, like, not enough in the budget about it. I just had thought that it might be a more focal point of his speech in terms of talking about the urgency of addressing it. And it was more like kind of ticking off a list of a couple things we're doing without really, you know, speaking to the need for doing these things and the urgency for tackling this crisis.
I mean, it's a hard thing to fix with money, certainly.
Right.
And, you know, he did say during his inaugural it was the you know, largest issue facing the state. Polling would bear out that that's a view shared by voters at this point. Lots to think about there. You know, what did you all make about how specific he was? I mean, it's still unclear to me how this sort of infrastructure fund might work. And why don't we take a listen to what the governor had to say on that topic?
Any surplus beyond increasing our rainy day fund to the total of $100 million will be placed in a newly created infrastructure revitalization fund. And barring unexpected expenses, savings beyond those funds will be sent directly to our local communities We have the opportunity to support their critical infrastructure needs, as well as dedicating resources to fight our opioid crisis.
All right, that's the governor talking about his infrastructure fund, which would be, you know, once the rainy day fund is sort of capped out, overage goes into that pot. And
it's a good example of what you said earlier, Josh, the luxury he has of budgeting in the wake of a fairly strong economic recovery. When's the last time you heard a governor in a budget address said, "So I have an idea for what we're going to do with all the money that's left over after we fill the rainy day fund"?
Never.
Never. And what the other thing that was interesting, it sort of dovetails with his this sort of almost moral lens through which he talked about the purity of his budgeting, that there's no tricks, there's no gimmicks, that there is a long tradition of taking one-time money, you know, surpluses, and using them to just put them for operating expenses. He made a very explicit point here, and we heard on yesterday Representative Neil Kirk, the chair of the House Finance Committee, sort of applauding the governor for this, for taking that surplus and using it for one-time expenses. So for, you know, single local road projects, rather than use it to pay, just kind of keep government fund the regular operating expense. But as you guys have pointed out, the details of how this money would be allocated, what would be the criteria for putting it out in towns, we've yet to really see that.
All right, stick around. More on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup and more on Governor Sununu's budget in just a moment on NHPR.
Virginia Prescott on the latest episode of the Civics 101 podcast. The Constitution clearly allows for amendments, but is a little vague on how to do it.
The Constitution actually says only in very terse terms how it expects this to work. And so whole questions like time limits, do they have to have the process finished within a certain period of time, are not really addressed.
Subscribe to Civics 101 and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or wherever you download yours.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or on Twitter and Facebook at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, and Dan Barrick from right here at NHPR. And before the break, we were talking about availability of money, and everybody's got their green budget summary out. How much money are we talking about in terms of, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is some of the outstanding issues that this budget addresses. It closes a gap at Health and Human Services that comes about due to, well, there are a variety of factors, but it's in the Medicaid program. It addresses the payment to plaintiffs in the Dover School funding lawsuit, and it assumes how much money is going to be left over, Kathleen?
Oh, $84 million for this infrastructure bank. So I think, politically, this is interesting, right? Because heading into the budget, we had all sorts of debate about what type of financial state Governor Hassan left the budget in. And you have Republicans saying that she was terrible at managing spending, and the only reason we're doing well is because our revenues are coming in high. And we have had revenues coming in very high over the past year, particularly with business taxes, which is partly what has allowed the governor to take care of a lot of these one-time issues, as well as have additional money left over to do some of the things he'd like to do. And on the flip side, you know, you see Democrats responding to the budget and saying, well, the only reason that you're able to do this is because of Governor Hassan's good management. So, I mean, with all of the – basically they're taking all of the money that's predicted to be left over when this budget ends June 30th. And, yeah, they're putting $50 million towards shortfalls in HHS, which have to deal with Medicaid caseloads that were a little bit larger than budgeted for, as well as some other issues. They're giving $2 million to dairy farmers. They're paying $9 million out to schools that had claimed that they were underfunded and won that lawsuit in court. And then they're saying they have $84 million left over, potentially, for this infrastructure bank that we're talking about, which will help schools and towns pay for things like roads and bridges or help them cover school building aid. So that, you know, that $84 million is a moving target. It might not actually be $84 million by the time we get to the end of June. And it's just, I think we've said this, but, you know, that's a one-time infrastructure bank, right? So we'll have $84 million bucks. They'll dole it out. And that's not something that, you know, is planned to come every 2 years after that. It's a one-time use of the surplus money.
It hasn't been articulated in any of the details as we have them now how money would go. We have infrastructure, we have essentially school building aid also coming out of that pile, but is it clear how that money would flow?
The mechanics are very fuzzy. I mean, there is a 10-year bridges and road transportation plan that the state has in place. It's prioritized all of the projects in order of safety and need, and it would ordinarily be funded, and they would just take the funding they get and work down that list in order of priority. Now, how this additional funding is going to come into play against that existing procedure is not entirely clear, and the same with school building aid. It sounds like there'll be some kind of application process set up outside of the regular appropriations to access this one-time pot of money that we might call the New Hampshire stimulus of 2017.
I mean, obviously, this is something that's going to need to be hashed out by lawmakers. And, you know, Dan mentioned House Finance Chairman Neil Kirk's enthusiasm for this concept. Why don't we take a listen to what he said yesterday after the speech?
That's an opportunity that I've never seen in many, many years of looking at budgets, where we're having a major program that would send money back to cities and towns for specific kinds of infrastructure development. This is not just property tax relief. It's to improve the infrastructure of the state.
All right. That was House Finance Chairman Neil Kirk, obviously sort of on board with this conceptually. And obviously every budget is a process. Before he rolled out the speech, Charlie Arlinghouse, the governor's budget director, told us that the governor really sees this as a conversation with lawmakers and that he plans to stay engaged. And there are always varying degrees of engagement. It's been a while since we had one party in the corner office, also controlling the legislature. How much of a honeymoon kind of front? I mean, how long will this last, do you think? I mean, do you think that it's going to be, you know, Chairman Kirk was said, well, we're just going to go through it the way we always do. Senator Morris has said the similar things. But do you think that there's going to be more kind of simpatico relations given they're all of the same party?
Well, we'll get a flavor of that next week when the governor and I'm assuming it'll be Charlie, but typically, shortly after the governor's budget address, the governor and their budget director present it to the House Finance Committee. So we'll get a sense of some of the back and forth there. But it's really hard to know. I mean, so far, you know, Governor Sununu has only been in office about a month. He's laid out a number of priorities outside of the budget that he's been interested in. Right to work. He said he would sign a right to work bill. That's been working through the legislature. I know we'll talk about that later, but he hasn't been terribly vocal about it. You know, some of the voting bills that he has expressed support for. Again, he's mentioned them, but I don't think he sent anyone from his office to testify. He's not held press conferences. So right now, I'm getting the indication he's more of a sort of watch from the sidelines as opposed to really use the bully pulpit type of governor. Whether that's going to change through this budget, we need to really see the legislature really engage to get a sense of that.
Right. And I think one of the interesting pieces as this goes through the legislative process, you know, we've been talking a lot about what's in the budget and not a lot about what's not in the budget. And I still have to, you know, compare everything the agencies asked for. But he made a big point to say, we looked at the budget requests that agencies made, all the things they said that they wanted, and we didn't give them a whole lot of that. And that's a point that Representative Kirk made as well. The reason that there is so much money to do some of these things like developmental disabilities and kindergarten is because a lot of state agencies are not seeing major increases over their normal budget. So instead of just kind of doing the typical, okay, we'll give you a little bit more than we gave you the year before to do X, Y, and Z things, the university system in particular, completely flat funded, no more money. So they're saying they can't do a tuition freeze. Other agencies, I don't have the specifics, but I'm surely asked for things that they didn't get. So that's going to be a whole process, too. They're probably going to be showing up to House Finance and maybe asking for things that they didn't get. And if the House chooses to put new things in, they're
something
going to have
to
eliminate some of these other priorities that the governor has.
Why don't we go to the phones? Chris is on the line from Nashua. Go ahead, Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I apologize. Maybe you covered this, but my concern is I didn't hear anything about how the governor plans to catch up on covering the underfunded pension liabilities that the state has accrued. I mean, that's not a small number, and I don't know if he's planning to address that or if he's going to kick that problem down the road like so many others have.
That was addressed in the budget, and it falls in that half-a-loaf approach once again, where the governor is proposing that the state pick up half of the unfunded liability, about $25 million, and let hopefully get the legislature to pass a legislation that would require the retirees to pick up the other half. There again, it's a solution that doesn't entirely please the extreme on either ends, the employee unions who thought that was a promise for their health care that should be fully funded, and a lot of lawmakers who think it was too generous of a promise. The burden should be on the employees as it is on so many retirees in the private sector. So instead, again, we have this middle of the road approach.
Well, that was on the health care, but are you talking about the retirement system or on what David was talking about, Chris? Okay. All right. Chris is not here. Hope that answers your question. Kathleen?
Yeah. And I don't think specifically I've not seen anything on the pension issue, but it certainly could be included in there. There's a lot to pick through on this, but that's something we'll certainly have to look for.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, you know, the one name that the governor mentioned as we look forward to how this works its way through the legislature during his speech, I think the only name he mentioned was Senator Chuck Morse, who has tended to have a pretty powerful hand in these budget years, former chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate president, expert in the budget, and also the beneficiary of having later revenue numbers, which can better inform spending. I mean, Dan, you know something about revenue estimating. I mean, what did you see in here that that stuck out and that you know, might change as we move through the process?
Well, the big story in terms of revenues of the last year and a half has been the business taxes. The big fight over the last budget 2 years ago was the Republican legislature's proposal to cut business tax rates. Governor Hassan opposed that. They went through. And business revenues, whether you believe that it's a direct result of the rate cuts or not, business taxes have been coming in at unseen levels. One thing that was interesting, it looks like in the governor's budget, he has slightly lower, he actually has business taxes coming in lower over the next 2 years, 2018, 2019, than they did last year, which, you know, not having seen the math that went into that is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, either they're, you know, lowballing it just to be conservative and safe, or they truly believe that you know, that
things are slowing down.
But if you were just to look at the trajectory of where business tax growth has been over the last year and a half and where Governor Sununu has it, it would appear to be a big drop off. That's one big question, I think, that given the importance of business taxes for funding state government here, that's going to be a big question that needs to be hammered out.
Yeah, and we'll also see in this budget the business tax rate is going to continue to go down further based on what was passed last year. So I don't, you know, Republicans tend to argue you lower the business taxes, you draw in more businesses, and therefore your overall revenue goes up. But I don't know if the cuts have anything to do with those projections that they're making. But that's really the only tax and fee change we're seeing in this budget, and that's not something even designed by him.
Were any of you surprised? I mean, one thing I was looking for potentially was, given, you know, what the governor said on the campaign trail, given that he's new in office, that he might want to, you know, kind of have his own tax cut in there, sort of like, you know, kind of mark the hydrant ideologically there. And, you know, that wasn't there. And maybe it speaks to David's notion that he's sort of trying to carve a sort of, you know, middle way, you know, while remaining, you know, fairly conservative within the mainstream of the Republican Party. But were you at all surprised that there wasn't something that was uniquely his? Like, I've reduced this tax. I talked to several Republicans who were expecting that. I was talking to some lobbyists before the speech of the State House. They were sort of surprised that didn't seem to be in the offing.
I mean, not terribly. I wouldn't have been shocked if it was, but not terribly. I mean, one, any, you know, it could potentially, depending on how his budget folks ran the numbers, it could have reduced the number of the amount of money available to him to spend. But then say the Republican House or Senate end up with a budget that does cut a tax rate, he can still take credit at the end of the day and say, we passed a budget with the tax cut. He doesn't necessarily have to put it in his document to claim political credit for it a year from now. So, you know, that may well happen by the time we get to June.
Yeah, and since we're already, I mean, we're still as a state kind of adjusting to and seeing how the reductions that we're already doing in business taxes are working. I mean, if he knows that business taxes are going down anyways, then, you know, that's something that he can sort of claim in his budget as well without doing anything additional that might, you know, have unknown consequences. We've seen good business taxes over the past year, but we still, you know, don't really know how those cuts are going to continue to play out.
Once again, tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. I guess we're going to leave the budget there for the moment. And why don't we shift to some of bills that were making their way through the legislature this week, some that were top priorities of Governor Sununu. And I guess I'm going to first turn to right to work, which has been something he's been pushing ever since he won election. He didn't talk about it much as a candidate. And that bill was voted down in House Labor Committee 14-7. What did you make of that, David?
It's been fairly well known that there's a large vein of resistance to right to work among 25, 30 or more Republican representatives in the House as it's currently composed, and that it was going to be a rough ride. We spoke to the speaker yesterday, and he says he's starting to diminish expectations that the vote in the House is even going to be close. They're expecting this to go down in the House by a fairly good margin. There's a lot of House members who are from very strong labor districts. They worry about running back at home for local positions and the power of the union. There are many who have philosophical concerns with government dictating the terms of a contract. And this was something that the governor went out on a limb for, thought he really had a chance for a big policy win. But as the speaker said yesterday, the best time for right to work in New Hampshire may have passed when it lost by only one vote in the House, I think, like 4 years ago.
Well, it was 10 days ago now at the Republican annual meeting when the governor addressed delegates. You know, he really used this as a rallying cry. He got up there and said, you know, are we going to let Democrats dictate what we do? Like, I don't think so. And, you know, Speaker Jasper, you know, when he spoke, he said, I'm going to get off the roster. I'm going to vote on the floor. And, you know, that's still what he's saying. But, you know, are you picking up the same thing David is when running around State House Council?
You know, I think that this is a perfect example, right, of, yes, Republicans control the governorship and the legislature, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're on the same page. Because, I mean, Sean Jasper is not – I would not even say that he's emphatically in support of this. I mean, when we spoke with him yesterday, you know, he was basically – and he acknowledged –
he's been criticized by some in the Republican Party for him being insufficiently.
He was talking to us and he said, I can see my majority leader over there, and he's shaking his head. He's not happy with what I'm saying. But he basically said, you know, if people don't want to vote for it, that's fine. It doesn't appear that he's doing a ton of arm twisting on this. He made some comment about the governor's involvement and saying that it like hasn't been a complete partnership between him and the governor on this issue. And, you know, it's still a little unclear to me how much arm twisting the governor is trying to do. And, you know, for all we know, maybe Jasper's downplaying expectations just to get Republicans riled up to maybe scare some people into voting for it. I don't know. But he's not, for something that the new Republican governor seems to want so badly, the Speaker of the House is really not giving him that. He is very, he's not bullish on its passage. And he's basically giving his members the go-ahead to not vote for it if they don't want to.
Do you find this surprising, Dan, given the push, not simply from the governor, from business groups? I mean, it is, you know, the arguments for this and against are familiar to all of us. But, you know, I guess I've been surprised to the degree to which people, you know, the Business Industry Association says, you know, this is the single biggest economic development tool that doesn't involve tax money at our disposal. Americans for Prosperity, the advocacy group, has really made it kind of a litmus test issue in Republican primaries.
But I still think it's one of these things that is of much greater import within the state house or political circles than the general public. This is, you ask your average voter, what is right to work and what does it mean? They don't know.
And to be clear, what it does mean is that is it forbids unions from collecting fees from non-members for cost of representation.
Right, to cover the cost of negotiating contracts that cover those non-union members. Part of that has to do with the fact that New Hampshire is such a low labor participation state. We have very little private sector unions. Most of the only real major unions in the state are, or the biggest unions in the state are public sector employees. So it's an issue that within Republican Party politics has been brewing for some time. Dave referenced just a few years ago when it lost by one vote. But I think to the general public, there's not a real sense that that this is a real issue that people vote on. So that may well have something to do with the politics of it within the legislature as well.
Well, and just to that point, you know, the speaker was saying that his concern is that he said that he lost his seat as the Hudson chair of the Hudson Board of Selectmen because he voted for right to work, and the union members in his town, he claims, you know, kind of got up against him. And, you know, if people are coming out against you and saying they voted for this anti-union bill or did whatever, and the general public doesn't have a real idea of what right to work is, you know, I could see why they would be worried about losing a seat when, as Dan said, most people don't really know what right to work is. They're just hearing this massive criticism about you and the votes that you took.
All right, that's an interesting backstory on Speaker Jasper and the Hudson Board of Selectmen. After the break, more Granite State headlines on the Exchange's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Stick around.
I'm Virginia Prescott on the latest episode of the Civics 101 podcast. The Constitution clearly allows for amendments, but is a little vague on how to do it.
the Constitution actually says only in very terse terms how it expects this to work. And so whole questions like time limits, do they have to have the process finished within a certain period of time, are not really addressed.
Subscribe to Civics 101 and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or wherever you download yours.
And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, do call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at NHPR or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, Dan Barrick from here at NHPR, and David Solomon, New Hampshire union leader. You know, we're talking right to work at the moment, and that will be voted on next week. So one way or another, it's going to be sort of yay or nay. Another issue that Governor Sununu talked about a lot in the wake of the campaign was, which is before the House in a committee this week, which is same-day voter registration. And that seems to have taken a turn south. He wanted to repeal it, Dan, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's the sponsor of that bill actually decided to pull it based on the conclusion that should New Hampshire get rid of same-day voter registration, we would be subject to the provisions of the Federal Motor Voter Act, which would in turn result in a great deal of additional costs for the state. This is something Sununu, he didn't say explicitly on the campaign trail same-day voter registration needs to go, but he would talk in vague terms about, you know, the laxness of the state's voting laws and claims about people being bused in from Massachusetts to vote. But then he said, I didn't mean that literally. This is one issue in which he said needs to be looked at, but there's still a dozen or so other provisions still floating through the legislature that would change the nature of the ID that's required, change the definition of residency for eligibility, put in a 13-day residency requirement for one could vote, and you know the arguments are sort of the same that we've heard. Most of these have the support of Republicans who raise doubts about the soundness of our elections, that people who are currently allowed to vote but should not be are influencing the outcome at the ballot box. Democrats saying that in fact a lot of these are targeted at students, young people, the poor, people who tend to vote Democratic. And you know what's slightly different this year is that, well, one, you have a Republican governor who's shown some interest in signing some of this legislation should it get to his desk, but this is obviously all happening in the shadow of a president who won office without the majority of the popular vote and has made a great deal of fuss about unfounded claims of illegal immigrants voting. So there is – it's happening. It's very difficult to have a sound policy debate about this in the current context.
Well, there's sort of a lot of moving parts. And, you know, for the record, the same-day registration, I mean, I think the numbers are 83,000 people, you know, registered and voted that way.
8 to 10% of
the conclusion of the bill's sponsor, Norman Silver is his name, Republican – that it would trigger motor voter requirements. You know, that's not a new – that wasn't a new conclusion. That's what people pretty much said out of the gate.
The Secretary of State's been saying that for a while, yeah.
But as far as these other sheaf of bills, many of them sponsored by House Republican David Bates, you know, it gets a little complicated where we're heading. I mean, do you expect that these are going to ultimately wend their way into – one bill, two bills, something that, you know, will be easier to digest?
It's hard to tell. I've heard that in the Senate they're kind of trying to get things together. There's only a couple bills in the Senate, but there's one in the Senate that's the 13-day residency requirement that is, you know, very, very complicated that David Bates himself has told me he doesn't think would pass constitutional muster. His bills are not quite as intense.
The lack of durational.
Yeah, his bill's lack of – I mean, I think where we're going, I think we will see something pass that changes the language in our statutes to say that you must be a resident to vote in New Hampshire. Right now we continue to use this vague term of domicile, which we've talked about before, and there are a lot of bills that deal with somehow changing – either just changing the word to resident or adding a residency requirement. There are some bills that add various things that you would use to prove that New Hampshire is, in fact, your domicile. And I think that, you know, there's a will of behind Republicans to get something done here. What exactly that looks like, I'm not sure. And Bates doesn't seem to be completely sure either. But I know that he has raised some questions about the bill in the Senate that does have the durational requirement and add some specific things like whether or not you have a driver's license as potential criteria for whether or not you can vote.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Attorney Brian Buonamano of the Attorney General's Office had to say testifying this week on a bill about the complexity of resident and how it applies in so many ways.
At this point, we don't know what the consequences of this bill are without actually going through in an exhaustive fashion and looking at each area where the residency definition is used, municipal, government, fish and game, driver's licenses, insurance, program eligibility, reduced tuition.
So residency pops up in a lot of areas of the law.
We're going to see some form of omnibus election bill come out of the legislature for the governor's signature. That's a pretty safe bet. And it's going to deal largely with this residency question and also, I believe, the stricter enforcement of the existing rules regarding voter affidavits signed by people who show up without photo ID. The speaker, I've been told, has been holding regular strategy sessions with Representative Bates, the sponsor of much of this legislation, and attorneys who we would not name, who are expert in legislation law, to try to line something up that's going to work right. They're going to find a bill that's got a support in the House and the Senate, probably a residency requirement issue, and attach amendments to that so that what's going to land on Sununu's desk is some kind of bill that addresses that question. Whether it ultimately settles the residency issue or not remains to be seen. Buonamano testified that the preference of the Attorney General is to seek a declaratory opinion from the state Supreme Court on the proper interpretation of the Constitution, which says any inhabitant of age whose domicile is in New Hampshire shall be able to vote. Doesn't address residency.
I mean, it's probably going to get to the courts one way or
another. One way or the other.
All right, why don't we go to the phones? Walter's on the line. Warner, good day, Walter. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was going back to the right to work law. I kind of liken it to if I have a problem, my neighbor has the same problem, and we need a lawyer, I hire the lawyer, I pay for it, and we both benefit from it. He gets a free ride.
All right, Walter, thank you. That's certainly a line of argument we've heard from critics of right to work. I've heard that example. I've heard, you know, if you both go into a bar and have a beer put in front of you and you know, one person reaches for their wallet, you know, certainly those on the other side would believe it's a freedom of choice issue in some measure. I'm going to be interested to see what this vote is. I haven't been terribly close to the sort of latest turn of the screw on this, but if it's as you folks say, the air may be coming out of this.
I think so, and we've certainly heard the arguments pro and con exhaustively in a lengthy day-long hearing before the Senate, and then three weeks later, 8 hours in front of the House of Representatives. So clearly there's a lot of passion on this, and I imagine when it comes up for a vote next week, we'll see the same turnout of protesters and on both sides.
Well, that's one bill. It seems like perhaps we'll see what happens with the vote, that they're having the kind of skids greased of kind of one party running things in Concord. You know, may not guarantee the result that backers of the proposal want.
We're not. It's not a parliamentary system where the majority party gets their program through without doubt. There's still a separation of powers, and governors throughout the years have found that they're having their party in power in the House of Representatives does not guarantee them a full vote on their platform.
It would also put, if in fact right to work were to fail in the House next week, it would put New Hampshire slightly at odds with a lot of other states that saw changes in incoming Republican government after the most recent election, and in which right to work legislation is already, Kentucky already passed one, I think.
Missouri
earlier.
Is also.
Yeah. So, a lot of the backers of right to work here have said, let's let New Hampshire be the first state in the Northeast to pass it. So this would, if in fact it does fail, it would sort of maintain this regional exception that the Northeast is one place where right to work has failed to take a toehold.
All right, but one bill that did make some headway this week that is something that is certainly its outcome is going to be changed by the change in the corner office is concealed carry. The House voted through a bill that would get rid of the requirement that one get a permit to carry a gun concealed. Not much drama there, Kathleen.
No, I mean, you know, Democrats certainly protested quite a bit, but we knew that this was going to get through. I believe now it's already passed the Senate, so it's heading to the governor's desk. And typically a governor, I think, has 5 business days to sign or veto legislation. So some point next week, we're probably going to see Governor Sununu signing this.
We have to make a pit stop at the Secretary of State's office, but he probably wants this one relatively quickly, so we will see. Why don't we go back to the phones? Alec is on the line from Holderness. Go ahead, Alec.
How are you doing? This right to work for less law. I mean, it's just political. The governor says he wants to bring jobs to New Hampshire, and yet he wants to pay them less, and he doesn't want them to have benefits. This is nuts. This is just like it's all political.
Are
it's
you in a like union, Alec?
I used to be. I'm retired, and I'm very comfortable because I was in a union. It's just like the death tags or the right to life. It's all misnamed. It's all political.
All right, Alec, thank you. It is, you know, there are a lot of things in this world that are political. This is one of, obviously, strong feelings. Again, a lot of people, and, you know, wandering the halls of the State House, I mean, certainly the lobbying on behalf of opponents of right to work, the unions, I mean, they've really reached out to, you know, as you need to on an issue like this, you know, kind of house member by house member, and, you know, it appears to be bearing fruit.
Alec's right. There's a thick crust of politics that's accrued around this issue. But there's also an interesting economic, I mean, when people who are able to pause and step out of the politics of it and look at it from an economic development issue, he's right. The governor said right to work will bring jobs. He and other people in the business community, the BIA, have said they've talked to out-of-state business owners who said we'd be interested in moving to New Hampshire were you to pass a right to work law. If you talk to most economists, though, they say the problem is not recruiting businesses here. It's about developing a workforce, that there's a real – with our low unemployment and an aging labor pool, the real problem is not drawing new business in. It's developing workers to fill the jobs that are already here. And I think that may well take us back to some of the – to the governor's budget and some of the investments he made. You know, he focused on breaking up the Department of Economic Resources and Economic Development to focus more on the economic development side. At the same time, you know, the university system may well quibble with his flat funding and saying the university system is one place that is a workforce development organization that is graduating skilled workers. Why is the state not investing more?
How big a debate do you think that will be, the university system? I mean, they, you know, they've sort of taken it on the chin in some budgets, done well other times. You know, obviously, saw some people affiliated with the university at the State House yesterday. They weren't looking too pleased.
They thought this was their chance. I mean, if you are not going to get a good boost in funding for the system in the current fiscal environment that the state is working under with a pot of money that they're virtually trying to create programs to spend and level funding the university is a huge disappointment. To the people there, chancellor right down to the student body, they thought they made a good offer to freeze tuition in return for a funding that would bring them fairly close to where they were 6 years ago when they were cut in half in terms of the state appropriation. And they've been trying, slowly eking their way back ever since. They got a sound rejection, and I don't think they'll get much sympathy on that. I think there's very little chance that's going to be reversed in a Republican-dominated legislature where, for various reasons, the university system has not been a favorite line item over the years.
Well, and I think there's a particularly interesting debate. I don't know if it will happen in the Republican House, but as Dave mentioned, they had said if they got the appropriation they asked for, they would be able to freeze tuition over the next 2 years. And instead, what the governor has chosen to do is create, you know, his $5 million scholarship fund, which he said will give scholarships to no less than 1,000 students. And so you've got this debate over giving the university system more money for something that they say will freeze tuition for all students versus creating a program that will dole out money to some students for tuition assistance. And I wonder if, you know, I would guess that might be an argument that might be made as the process goes forward. I don't know specifically, but, you know, we can bet that the university system is going to be fighting very hard to get some additional funding. But as Dave mentions, you know, it's not They've not always been looked super favorably upon. And the House Education Committee Chairman, Rick Ladd, as well, was really excited about the governor's proposal to give money to the community college system. And so I think that we're going to see Republican lawmakers getting behind that.
Well, and certainly some of the UNH has had some sort of unfortunate headlines in the last year. The sort of infamous scoreboard that you know, may have its merits. I didn't pay too much attention to the story, but it came in the wake of, you know, a guy who worked in the library who, you know, lived an incredibly frugal life, apparently, and managed to give UNH a rather hefty sum of money. And this table in the dining hall, which I forget what it cost. It was quite expensive.
I think it was like $16,000.
Yes. And so, those are examples that would sort of resonate with a House member in particular in a way that might make it a tough road for USNH this year.
Well, yeah, and I think we also had some of those headlines about political correctness. There was a story in the Union Leader about whether or not the Women's Studies Department was, you know, advocating one political view over another. So you can imagine some of those things coming up in the debate as well.
Okay, we have an email from Kyle who asks, when the governor signs the gun permit bill, how long does it take to go into effect? Does anyone know the effective date on that?
I don't know the effective dates on the specific legislation. Yeah. So it could be, I mean, bills could be that it takes effect immediately, or it could be, you know, June 30th or something.
All right, Kyle, thanks for the email. We have another email on this topic. After it's signed, can it ever be repealed? Anything can be repealed if the legislature wills it. That's the way
it works.
Yeah,
and I think rather than what they would probably have to do rather than right now, they're repealing something. So what the future legislature would have to do would be to reinstate this requirement that you have to get some type of license or permitting. And, you know, who knows if our legislature ends up back in Democratic hands, you can be pretty certain that this is something that will come up.
All right. We're almost to the end of the show. So, yeah, obviously this week, a lot of focus on the budget. We're all going to be sifting through the particulars, at least for the near term. Anything else that you're looking towards next week, David?
Well, next week, by the end of next week, DHH, the Department of Health and Human Services, is going to have to come forward with the specifics of how they're going to address their $65 million shortfall. Looks like about $50 million of it will be achieved through dedication of surplus funds, but they're still going to have to come up with some other ways to balance the books by the end of the year. It'll be interesting to see what services and positions that plan might affect.
Kathleen?
As we just talked about, right to work is going to be up for a vote next week in the House, so we'll finally know if it's happening or not.
All right, and Dan?
House Finance Committee next week gets its hands on governor's budget, so that'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on.
It'd be interesting to see the way he drops it off, too. It's always interesting. You know, I asked the governor last week if he planned to do much testifying on bills, which is something some governors do, some governors don't. He didn't come down with any sort of hard answer, but, he likes to consider himself a persuasive salesman. The House Finance Committee can be a tough crowd at times. Thank you all. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.